Do you see the deals on these brands?
Of course you can't. This is a podcast.
But when you go to Ross this spring, you'll see brands you know at prices you love. We're talking all the shoes, hues, and oohs at 20 to 60% off department store prices. Go see the savings at Ross.
In March 1896, if you were someone who followed international news, you certainly could not have missed the remarkable headlines coming out of East Africa. On March 3rd, the New York Times proclaimed, quote, "Abyssinians defeat Italians," end quote. The reporting was a mix of shock and incredulity at the stunning turn of fortunes for the colonial Italian forces in Africa. As the Times would write a day later on March 4th, quote, "The present campaign against the Abyssinians threatens to become one of the most disastrous in which the Italian arms have ever taken part," end quote. Now, if you're not familiar with the term Abyssinian, you can be forgiven. Abyssinia is a term rarely still used for a country better known as Ethiopia. These reports were referring to the Battle of Adwa, a historic confrontation between the Ethiopians and the Italians. At this battle, King Menelik II, Emperor of Ethiopia, scored a crushing and conclusive victory over the invading Italian forces. For their part, the Italians, who had only a few decades earlier united their peninsula into the modern nation of Italy, had been trying to get a piece of the African continent. The so-called 19th century scramble for Africa was nearing its end, with the vast majority of the continent having fallen under the control of the British, French, Portuguese, Germans, and King Leopold II's Belgians. One of the last parts of the African continent free from colonial domination was the ancient kingdom of Ethiopia. A few years earlier, the Italians had managed to snap up the coastal territory of Eritrea, but in 1893, a dispute over a mistranslated treaty sent the Ethiopians and the Italians to war. Now, many assumed that the Italians, like many European colonizers before them, would make quick work of their African adversaries, but these assumptions proved to be incredibly wrong. The Italians underestimated the level of organization and technical sophistication possessed by the Ethiopians. Perhaps more significantly, they had underestimated the Ethiopian leader, King Menelik II, who proved to be a bit of a strategic genius. On March 1st, the war was settled at the Battle of Adwa. An ethnically diverse Ethiopian force numbering 100,000 soldiers completely overwhelmed an Italian force of roughly 25,000. Despite their superior defensive position, the Italians had chosen to advance on the much larger Ethiopian force, with disastrous results. The Ethiopian victory was unequivocal. The Battle of Adwa would prove to have huge consequences, both in the short term and the long term. The Ethiopian victory ensured the nation's independence until the Second World War, when once again the nation would need to defend itself against the Italians, albeit under very different leadership. But in 1896, the result of the Battle of Adwa led to the nearly immediate collapse of the ruling party in the Italian parliament. The news of the Italian defeat inspired protesters to take to the streets of Rome, disgusted with the government's reckless colonial adventures. Before the week was out, the Italian prime minister had resigned. A new treaty was signed, fully recognizing the independence and sovereignty of the Ethiopian kingdom. But beyond the immediate political ramifications, the victory at Adwa also had deeper social and cultural meanings, especially for people of African ancestry the world over. This victory struck at the heart of narratives about white supremacy. King Menelik had quite viscerally demonstrated that the conquest of African peoples by Europeans was not simply a foregone conclusion, Many were inspired by this. The victory resonated especially profoundly with many African American, Black, Latin American, and Afro-Caribbean people who were in the midst of their own struggles for equality and civil rights. The battle at Adwa galvanized a new movement known as Pan-Africanism that stressed the common history and destiny for anyone of African descent. That movement looked to Ethiopia as a global leader for Black people everywhere. For some, including Jamaica's nascent Rastafarian movement, the Ethiopian kings became akin to messianic figures. Many Rastas believed that Menelik II's eventual successor, Haile Selassie, was no less than the second coming of Jesus Christ. So weirdly, without Menelik II, we might not have had Bob Marley, or at least we would have had a very different Bob Marley. In hindsight, it would seem like the Battle of Adwa heralded the beginning of the end of the colonial era. While it would take decades for decolonization to really pick up steam, the Battle of Adwa could be used to mark a turning of the tide. So, how did Menelik II do it? How did he manage to win the day at Adwa? Well, military historians have litigated this ever since. Some have pointed to a number of disastrous Italian blunders instigated by insubordinate commanders. Others have pointed to Menelik's superior numbers and his well-equipped and impressively disciplined army. Still others have explained that Menelik was simply the superior strategist. In the lead-up to the battle, he fed the Italians disinformation while he stockpiled weapons and built an unstoppable army. He avoided being baited into losing battles and struck exactly when he knew he could win. But there are others who credit the Ethiopian victory to something more spiritual. Indeed, when the war with the Italians looked imminent, Menelik had issued a statement declaring, quote, "Ethiopia has need of no one. She stretches out her hands onto God," end quote. To be honest, it was kind of a badass thing to say, and almost seems designed to resonate with a European, or at least a Christian, audience. The statement directly quoted Psalm 68:31, where it's written that, quote, "Princes shall come out of Egypt. Ethiopia shall soon stretch out her hands onto God," end quote. Menelik's declaration was a reminder that Ethiopia had a special place within Christendom, and anyone that knew their Bible verses had to recognize it. It was a subtle way of saying, God is on our side. You see, there are some who believe that on that day, Menelik didn't just pray to God. He unleashed what could be described as a spiritual super weapon. Yes, there's a belief that the Ark of the Covenant has been safely squirreled away in Ethiopia for centuries. This super powerful, divinely designed box that once held the tablets of the Ten Commandments was credited in the Old Testament with helping the ancient Israelites defeat their enemies on the field of battle. Some of the more superstitious commentators have suggested that the Ark may have given King Menelik II the edge he needed at Adwa in 1896. But hold on. What? Does anyone truly believe that supernatural weapons were used on a modern battlefield? And more importantly, how did the nation of Ethiopia ever get its hands on the Ark of the Covenant? Is there anything to this wild story? Let's unpack it today on Our Fake History.
One, two, three, four.
Episode number 131. Does Ethiopia have the Ark of the Covenant? Part 1. Hello and welcome to Our Fake History. My name is Sebastian Major, and this is the podcast that explores historical myths and tries to determine what's fact, what's fiction, and what is such a good story that it simply must be told. This week, we are heading to a part of the world that has fascinated me for quite a long time, and that is Ethiopia. The East African nation belongs to a small, elite group of geographic locales where settled human civilization first started to flourish. These are places like Mesopotamia, the Indus Valley, the Yellow and Yangtze Rivers, the Nile Valley, and Central America. You could also argue that the Ethiopian highlands and the East African coast should be on that list. This part of East Africa has been home to human cultures as long as we've had human cultures. In fact, Ethiopia has been home to humans basically as long as we've had humans. Some of the earliest known remains of early hominids have been found in Ethiopia. The famous remains of the pre-human creature known as Australopithecus afarensis, nicknamed Lucy, were found in Ethiopia. The first Homo sapiens seem to have made an early home in this region. In fact, the oldest known stone tools ever found anywhere in the world were uncovered in this country. What's more, the societies that developed in that region would go on to become some of the most consequential in the ancient world. In the 3rd century, a Persian religious teacher and prophet known as Mani wrote a list of what he thought were the world's 4 greatest societies. He wrote, quote, "There are 4 great kingdoms on earth. The first is the kingdom of Babylon and Persia. The second is the kingdom of Rome. The third is the kingdom of the Aksumites. And the fourth is the kingdom of the Chinese." End quote. Now, I bet most of you know 3 of those 4 great kingdoms. The Romans, the Persians, the Chinese. I mean, they have a reputation that precedes them. But I'm sure some of you were scratching your head going, wait, who are the Aksumites? But of course, there's probably some others out there who were like, I see where you're going with this, buddy. Those Aksumites, they must be the ancient Ethiopians. And you would be correct. The Aksumites were one of many important civilizations that grew out of what we today consider Ethiopia, the capital city of Aksum being smack dab in the middle of the Ethiopian highlands. Now, this little list is very telling, as it demonstrates just how important the civilization of the Ethiopians was in the minds of 3rd century thinkers. Mani clearly had no qualms setting Ethiopia alongside Rome and China as one of the world's most developed societies. But clearly, the perception of Ethiopia has changed drastically since the 3rd century, especially in the West. Ethiopia is rarely given its due as a significant historical player, a place that both affected and was affected by geopolitics. Instead, Ethiopia often gets treated as a total curiosity. There's a long tradition of writing about Ethiopia like it's some kind of lost kingdom. The fact that Ethiopia has an ancient and unique Orthodox Christian religion is sometimes treated as a weird anomaly within Christianity. This is to say nothing of Ethiopia's Jewish population, which can be treated with a certain type of slack-jawed bewilderment. Ethiopia's unique architecture, literature, and art is often described by Westerners as deeply mysterious, to the point of being unexplainable. In the late medieval and early modern periods, Europeans had no problem equating Ethiopia with the mythical kingdom of Prester John. Head back to episode 57 for more on that. This trope of discussing Ethiopia like a fictional land of legend has even influenced relatively recent books on the topic. The controversial author Dean Arnold titled his 2019 book on the country's history, Unknown Empire, The True Story of Mysterious Ethiopia and the Future Arc of Civilization. Even the respected scholar Stuart Monroe Hay couldn't resist titling his 2002 guide to Ethiopia's architectural treasures as Ethiopia, the Unknown Land. And that one really bugged me, because I think Monroe Hay should have known better. This recurring theme of Ethiopia being an unknown land or a mysterious place just reeks of Orientalism. Now, I've discussed Orientalism many times before on this podcast, so hopefully I don't need to define it again. But this falls neatly into the old trope of Western writers defining the East as a mystical, mysterious, magical place whose secrets can never be fully understood. When a place that has been home to human society since the beginning of time gets described as unknown, you have to ask, unknown to who? To the people who live there, that place is known. As we can see in that quote from the 3rd century Persian prophet, even to outsiders, Ethiopia was not an unknown place in late antiquity. Quite the opposite. According to that writer, it was one of the 4 best-known places on the planet. When we frame Ethiopia as somehow separate from the rest of the world, indeed it does seem surprising. Its religion, culture, and regional mythology seem bewildering. But I'm going to argue that as soon as we start seeing Ethiopia as one of history's great cultural meeting places, as opposed to some unknown and hidden society, then all of a sudden, many things about the country start to make a lot more sense. But I'm getting a little ahead of myself here. You see, while I firmly believe that Ethiopia's mysterious reputation is very much a construction promoted by outsiders, the Ethiopians themselves have long believed that their country is a special place with a unique destiny among the nations of the world. The ancient kingdom of Aksum, in what is today northern Ethiopia, was potentially the first place on earth to make Christianity the official religion. I say potentially only because the people of Armenia have a competing claim. But it's clear that Aksum was a firmly Christian kingdom many decades before Emperor Theodosius would declare Christianity to be the official religion of the Roman Empire. So the Ethiopians do have a unique place in the history of Christianity. It was one of the first places, if not the first place, where the religion firmly took root and was embraced as the state religion. As such, some religious Ethiopians perceive their country the way pious Jews see Israel. It's a country that has a special relationship with God, a place where God's presence can be felt more profoundly. If it's not the Holy Land, then it's at least a Holy Land. So while Ethiopians might object to the idea that they are unknown, they seem pretty good with the idea that they're special. Now, before I go any further, I should say that I do not presume to speak for Ethiopians. Before this episode came out, I really tried to reach out through social media to see if there were any Ethiopians in my audience who might be able to give me some more insight on all of this. Sadly, I didn't get anything back in time. But if you're listening to this and you are Ethiopian, I would love to hear from you. So send me an email at ourfakehistory@gmail.com. But that's not to say that I didn't have help. I would like to thank Andy from the History of Africa podcast for answering a number of my questions about the history of Ethiopia. So if you're interested in learning a ton more about the history of Ethiopia and the African continent in general, then please check out the History of Africa podcast. They're a relatively new show, and it's tough starting out as a new history podcast. I know from experience. They're doing a real good job over there at the History of Africa pod, so show them some love, subscribe, learn a few things about Africa. Thanks again to everyone over at the History of Africa podcast for all your help today. Okay, so one of the keys to understanding Ethiopia's special status is the country's relationship with the Ark of the Covenant, the holy box spoken about in the Old Testament containing the tablets upon which God wrote the Ten Commandments. Now, if you're not particularly religious, then you might know it from the Indiana Jones movie. This is the lost ark that the raiders were, raiding. It's an object that has deep religious significance, especially for Jews, but also for Christians and Muslims. But it's also an object that is thought to have been destroyed roughly 2,500 years ago. Unless, of course, you ask those devoted to Ethiopia's Orthodox Church. They would tell you that the Ark is still completely intact and is safely guarded in Ethiopia. Specifically, the Ark is said to be housed in the old city of Aksum, in the inner sanctum of the Church of Our Lady Mary of Zion. How did it get there? Well, it's a long story, and one I want to explore over the course of this series. But I can't mention the Church of Our Lady Mary of Zion without taking a moment to acknowledge the recent tragedy that took place there just a few months ago. As I'm sure some of you may know, Ethiopia's Tigray region, which is the home of the city of Aksum and its famous church, has recently been consumed by violence in a conflict that has become known as the Tigray War. This conflict has been marked by war crimes committed by many of the belligerent parties. In one particularly brutal incident this past November, roughly 800 people hiding inside the church were chased out and shot. Details about this event have been dripping out of the region ever since, which means it may be some time before we get a clear idea of what exactly happened. But it's worth noting that a number of different sources, including the Associated Press, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and the Ethiopian Human Rights Commission, have all confirmed that this massacre took place and have attributed it to the Eritrean Defense Force. It's a tragedy whose wounds are still fresh, and that needs to be acknowledged and respected. The causes and complexities of the Tigray War are beyond the scope of this podcast. So I'm just going to encourage all of you to learn more about this. Please, research the Tigray War. But even in the reporting of this recent massacre, rumors about the Ark of the Covenant still managed to creep into some of the articles about it. The staff writers at the Catholic news agency couldn't resist printing the local rumor that the attackers had targeted the church in hopes of capturing the Ark. Now, it's impossible to know if this is true, but it's notable that even today, the legend of the Ark remains potent. So with all due respect to the recent tragedy, let's break this down. What is the Ark of the Covenant? Why do some people think it's in the Tigray region of northern Ethiopia? And how does all of this affect our understanding of this remarkable country? Well, let's take a closer look. Before we can really dive into the history of Ethiopia, I think we need to do a crash course on the Ark of the Covenant. So first, let's address any confusion between the Ark of the Covenant and Noah's Ark, because people do get these two things confused. When I told Our Fake History artist in residence, Frank Fiorentino, that this week's show was going to be about Ethiopia's connection to the Ark, he was like, wait, I thought you just did a whole series about the flood. No, I had to say. The other Ark. Now, it's kind of ridiculous that there are two very different things in the Old Testament known as the Ark. But it turns out this is actually just a quirk of translation. Those of you out there who can read the Torah in its original Hebrew, I'm looking at my rabbis in the crowd, you know that two very different words are used for Noah's big old boat and the chest known as the Ark of the Covenant. In Hebrew, the boat is referred to as a tava, whereas the special chest is called an aron. Now, I have read that both of these words generally mean a safe container, but the word tava tends to be used for boats or other safe on-water transportation. When the Old Testament was translated into Latin, both words were translated as arca, the Latin word for chest. Then, when the book was translated into English, arca became ark. Now, this was a weird choice because ark is a word that we don't really use in English other than to refer to these two very different biblical things. This is just a recipe for confusion and another piece of evidence in my ongoing exploration of how the English language is silly, arbitrary, and should not be taken seriously by anyone. And that's coming from someone who teaches English. Anyway, we're not talking about the Tava, Noah's Ark. We're talking about the Aron, the Ark of the Covenant. Now, for those of you who aren't familiar with the Old Testament or the Torah, the Ark of the Covenant is first introduced at the end of the book of Exodus. At this point in the story, the Hebrew people, led by Moses, have escaped slavery in Egypt and have arrived at the base of Mount Sinai. There, God appeared to the Jewish people in the form of a cloud atop a mountain. Moses was called to the top of the mountain, where he stayed for 40 days and 40 nights. Now, I'm sure most of you know that this is when God famously gave the Jewish people the Ten Commandments. After the voice of God proclaimed these commandments for all of Israel to hear, Moses was then given two tablets containing these rules. Now, if your knowledge of the Old Testament mostly comes from Charlton Heston movies, you can be forgiven for thinking that all Moses got on top of the mountain were those 10 rules. But oh no. Fans of the Torah know that the 10 commandments were just the beginning. The book of Exodus tells us that over 40 days and 40 nights, God articulated an entire civil and legal framework known as the Covenant Code. But most importantly for our story, at that time, he also told Moses exactly how to build an important ritual tent known as the tabernacle and an even more important ritual chest known as, you guessed it, the Ark of the Covenant. God told Moses that the point of both of these objects was so that his presence may dwell among his chosen people wherever they may travel. So the tabernacle was essentially a portable temple, and the Ark was the focus of that temple. It was to be the container that held the Ten Commandments. The Ark was to be placed in the inner sanctum of the tabernacle, in a place known as the Holiest of Holies. Now, it wasn't just some fancy box. It was thought to be the place where God's presence was most acutely concentrated on earth. Tradition would later have it that aside from containing the tablets of the Ten Commandments, the Ark also contained a jar of manna. That was the divine food that God provided for the Jews in the desert. Also in the ark was the staff of Aaron. That's Moses' brother. Aaron's staff was associated with all sorts of miracles and was generally seen as a symbol of leadership among the ancient Jews. So the ark was home to all sorts of holy relics. But all of those relics were really secondary to the Spirit of God that was thought to emanate from the ark. Now, if you've read the book of Exodus, then you know how curiously long the section about building the tabernacle and the ark is. Now, the Old Testament's funny like that. It'll just skate right past a huge miraculous moment, and then you'll get pages on pages of ancient building instructions. The book of Exodus is very specific about how both the tabernacle and the Ark of the Covenant should be constructed. Now, this can make for some rather tedious reading, but we do know exactly how the Ark of the Covenant should have looked. God told Moses that the ark should be built of acacia wood and should be entirely overlaid with gold inside and out. It should have had four rings attached to its feet so long poles could be slid through and the ark could be carried about. Now, this was an important point. No one was supposed to touch the ark after it was constructed. It could only be moved using those two special poles. Now, the coolest part of the ark has to be the lid, or what the Torah calls the atoning cover. The lid was to be cast out of pure gold and decorated with two golden angels, or cherubim. The angels were supposed to be facing each other with their heads directed down towards the lid of the ark. Then their giant wings were to be outstretched, almost touching each other. This little gap between the two angels' wings was important. In Exodus, God explains this tiny space, saying, quote, "There I will meet you, and from above the atoning cover, between the two cherubim which are upon the Ark of the Testimony, I will speak to you about every commandment that I will give you for the sons of Israel." End quote. So, God makes it pretty clear. He's gonna live in that spot between those two wings. Cool. So after the whole scene at Mount Sinai, we're told that the ark and the tabernacle are constructed exactly as God specified, and it was taken with the Israelites as they set about claiming the land of Canaan, the land promised to them by God as part of the covenant. Now, after the book of Exodus, the ark plays a really interesting role in the rest of the Old Testament. Aside from being a site of worship for the ancient Jews, it also had an important military function. We're told that as the Jews headed into the land of Canaan, they carried the ark before them in the vanguard. The power of the ark is said to have dried up rivers and cleared a path for the marching Israelites. But the most famous use of the ark in the Old Testament was during the Battle of Jericho, as described in the book of Joshua. Jericho was a key city in the conquest of the Holy Land, or at least so we're told in the Bible. In the book of Joshua, we're told that the ark was brought out and marched around the city walls of Jericho once a day for 6 days. On the seventh day, they completed 7 circuits with the ark. The priests blew their horns, and the walls of Jericho fell. So, in the Bible, the ark basically cleared the way for the entire conquest of Canaan. This is why, when you encounter the Ark of the Covenant on, say, the History Channel, it's often in the context of a paranormal or ancient aliens-themed show that asks the question, was the Ark an ancient superweapon? And I mean, yeah, sure. I mean, if you're reading the Old Testament literally, then I guess it was. But Just calling it a weapon somewhat diminishes its importance as a religious object. If you are a believing Jew, then the Ark of the Covenant is as close as you get to God on earth. In the Old Testament, the Ark demanded a certain level of respect. In the book of 1 Samuel, 70 men are struck dead just for looking at the Ark the wrong way. In 2 Samuel, a cart driver named Uzzah is tasked with moving the Ark for the famous King David. Uzzah thought the Ark was tipping over, so he reached out his hand to steady it, and he was immediately struck dead by God. Sorry, Uzzah, but you just don't touch the Ark. But according to the Old Testament, it was King David who ultimately brought the Ark of the Covenant into Jerusalem, where it would rest. David chose Mount Moriah as the site of a temple to house the Ark, but we're told that God would not let him build that temple. Turns out that David had spilled too much blood in his wars uniting the ancient kingdom of Israel. Instead, David's son, the wise King Solomon, was tasked with building the temple of the Lord. The temple, sometimes called the First Temple or Solomon's Temple, was meant to be a permanent stone version of the tabernacle first described to Moses. Inside that temple would be a windowless chamber known as the new Holy of Holies. There, we are told, the Ark was placed, and there it rested. In the time of the First Temple, the Ark was only to be seen once a year on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. It could only be consulted by the high priest, who would approach the Ark reverently, burning incense and carrying an offering of lamb's blood. Tradition has it that a rope was actually tied to the leg of the priest, just in case he looked at the Ark the wrong way, or maybe accidentally touched it and was struck dead by God. The rope was there just to drag out his dead body so no one else would have to enter the Holy of Holies. So there in Jerusalem on the Temple Mount is where the Ark rested and the presence of God dwelt for nearly 400 years. Unless, of course, you ask the Ethiopians. You see, the biblical account tells us that the Ark was lost after the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar sacked Jerusalem and destroyed Solomon's temple. Now, the sacking of Jerusalem by the Babylonians is an event that we can say 100% for certain did happen. That's because it's attested to by historical sources outside of the Bible. There are Babylonian sources that very specifically speak about the sacking of Jerusalem. And if you listen to the Gilgamesh shows and you're wondering, yes, those sources were written on cuneiform tablets. The sacking of Jerusalem is thought to have taken place in either 586 or 587 BC. Now, we know that the sacking of the city would lead to the captivity of the Jewish priestly caste, who would all be shipped off to exile in Babylon. Interestingly, it was during this period of exile that most scholars think that the Torah took the form that we know it as today. The exiled priests used their time to collect together a group of sacred stories, then edited and redacted them, and gave us what we now think of as the Pentateuch, or the first five books of the Hebrew Bible. But the destruction of the first temple meant that the Ark was lost, presumably carried off by the Babylonians as a piece of loot, or potentially destroyed in the fires that consumed the first temple. For many, the story of the Ark ends right there in 587 BC. But others, including some of Judaism's most respected early rabbis, believe that the Ark was not lost, and it was only hidden away, waiting to be found. The Ethiopians go even a step further. The Babylonian sack of Jerusalem could not have destroyed the Ark of the Covenant, because the Ark of the Covenant wasn't in Jerusalem on that day. The Ethiopians tell us that by that point, the Ark had not been in Jerusalem for many centuries. No, the Ark was safely tucked away in Ethiopia. So, how did it get there? Well, the Ethiopians have a pretty interesting explanation for that. So let's get our head out of the Old Testament and into a very different ancient text, a book known as the Kebra Nagast, the Ethiopian national epic. What can the Kebra Nagast tell us about the Ark of the Covenant? Well, let's find out. To understand Ethiopia's claim to the Ark of the Covenant, we have to look at a source known as the Kebra Nagast. Now, I really hope I'm pronouncing that one correctly. Ethiopians, I'm sure you will let me know. The Kebra Nagast is one of the most important books for Ethiopian Christians that isn't technically part of the Bible. It often gets called a national epic, but that somehow underplays the important spiritual dimension of this work. The Kebra Nagast tells a story that connects Ethiopia's Orthodox Church and its line of kings to the patriarchs of the Old Testament. It also contains an amazing tale about the ultimate fate of the Ark of the Covenant. Those who believe in the historical accuracy of the Kebra Nagast see it as evidence that Ethiopia's kings were the direct descendants of King Solomon himself. These kings actually referred to themselves as the Solomonic line of kings. So, you know, they took this pretty seriously. Now, later on in this series, I want to explore what we know about the composition of this book and how its version of Ethiopia's past lines up with what we know from other historical sources. But before we get into any of that, first, I should just tell you the story that gets presented in the Kebra Nagast, because, man oh man, it is interesting. Now, as usual, this is the Sebastian Major summary of this story. If you want the proper beat-by-beat breakdown, then I encourage you to find a translation of the Kebra Nagast and read it for yourself. I will also have a link at ourfakehistory.com to an online resource if you want to check it out. And by the way, go to ourfakehistory.com to see the bibliographies for all of my episodes. I should really mention that more often. Before I get started, I should also note that I'm only going to be focusing on the part of this text that has to do with the Ark of the Covenant. There's lots of theological discussion and bits of mysticism in this book as well, but I'm really not going to be getting into that here. So, you know, enjoy reading that on your own time. Okay, so let's get into it. The Kebra Nagast has a fascinating framing device at its outset. The whole story is presented as a debate between a number of august Christian church fathers at the famous Council of Nicaea. Now, Nicaea has come up on this podcast many times before. As I'm sure many of you remember, this was the council called by the Roman Emperor Constantine that was meant to resolve a number of church controversies and create a consistent Christian theology. The Kebra Nagast uses the council as a way into the story. In the book, the church fathers are debating the question of the glory of kings. In fact, the name Kibra Nigust roughly translates to the glory of kings. Specifically, they're concerned with where the glory of kings originates and what it consists of. It's the kind of hyper-specific philosophical debate that seems fitting for the church fathers. Of course, they conclude that the glory of kings is but a reflection of the glory of God. And interestingly, one of the most concrete reflections of the glory of God on earth was stored in the Ark of the Covenant. This inspires one of the church fathers to whip out a book he claims he found in an ancient church that explains the ultimate fate of the Ark. So, here we have a book within a book. I love this kind of stuff. So the next 75 chapters of the Kibra Nigust are essentially a retelling of the tale found in that mysterious book presented at the Council of Nicaea. Following so far? This book tells the tale of a figure known as Makeda, but you might know her better as the Queen of Sheba. Now, in the Bible, the Queen of Sheba is a pretty obscure figure. She's mentioned very briefly in the book of 1 Kings as a queen from a southern land who brought a caravan of rich gifts to the wise King Solomon. We're told in 1 Kings that she spoke with Solomon very briefly, he shared his great wisdom with her, and then she left. In the New Testament, she is referenced very briefly as a queen of the south. But beyond that, we don't hear much more about the Queen of Sheba. Well, this book tells a much more elaborate story. Here, the Queen of Sheba is none other than Makeda, the queen of ancient Ethiopia. We're told that her father was basically a dragon slayer, a man who had killed the tyrannical snake king of the region known as Arwe. So, the Queen of Sheba comes from a rather impressive pedigree, at least according to the Kibra Nigust. Like in the book of 1 Kings, we're told that the queen visited Solomon in Jerusalem in hopes of establishing trade with his great kingdom and benefiting from his storied wisdom. But in this version, her visit is far more eventful. We're told that as soon as Solomon laid his eyes on the beautiful queen, he immediately fell in love. He insisted that she join him for dinner and stay the night at his palace. At dinner, they enjoyed a deep conversation where both Solomon and the Queen of Sheba demonstrated their impressive intellects. The cheeky Solomon then suggested that perhaps they might share a room that night. Now, the modest queen said that she simply could not share a room with someone she just met, even if he was the wise King Solomon. So, Solomon struck a deal with her. He said that he would sleep in a separate bed and he would not touch the queen, so long as she promised not to steal anything from his palace. Now, this seemed easy enough for the queen. All you gotta do is not be a thief. But little did she know that King Solomon had actually slipped something into her food. Or purposely had the food made very spicy. I've seen different translations of this. Either way, kind of a slippery move. But Solomon made sure that the queen left dinner incredibly thirsty. Eventually, the thirst became too much and the queen reached for the nearest pitcher of water. Just then, King Solomon popped out and was like, "Ha ha, you stole from me, for water is the most important thing of all. So, deal's off." Well, the queen relented. And despite that she was basically tricked into this whole thing, The text tells us that she willingly and happily spent the night with King Solomon. Sure enough, the queen then became pregnant with Solomon's child. That night, though, Solomon had a dream that he saw a beautiful, brilliant sun resting over Israel. But then it flew away and rested over Ethiopia, where it shone more brightly than ever. This dream would prove to be prophetic. On her long trek back to her kingdom, the queen gave birth to a healthy baby boy, the future king Menelik I. Well, the years passed, and the boy grew into an impressive and handsome young man. Then, when he turned 22, Menelik decided that he would make the trek back to Jerusalem to finally meet his biological father. When Menelik arrived at Solomon's court in Jerusalem, the king completely embraced his long-lost son. He showered the young man with love and praise. He even noted that the dashing young Menelik looked quite a lot like his own father, the great King David. In fact, King Solomon was so taken with Menelik that he got an idea. This was an excellent opportunity for the United Kingdom of Israel to spread its influence to the far corners of the world. The descendants of David could now rule not one, but two great kingdoms. So he decreed that the firstborn children of all of his nobles at court were to accompany Menelik back to Ethiopia. This would have the effect of replicating the court in Jerusalem in Menelik's capital. Well, Menelik was honored by this, and the plan was eagerly embraced. However, the firstborn children of the Israelite nobility were a little less excited about this. While they had nothing against Menelik, the thought of leaving Jerusalem was difficult, specifically because they would be so far from the temple and the Ark of the Covenant that rested inside the Holy of Holies. Being so far away from the Ark was too much for some of them to bear. So the son of the high priest, a young man named Azarias, decided that the entourage was going to steal the Ark of the Covenant and bring it with them back to Ethiopia. This would all be done without Menelik's knowledge, of course, as the prince would surely object to stealing from his father. Well, God seems to have approved of this plan. So that night, he sent the archangel Michael to Azarias. Michael directed Azarias to go into the temple with four other men, to remove the ark by its wooden carrying poles, and in its place, he was to put a large piece of scrap wood. This scrap wood would then be covered with a purple veil that was traditionally used to cover the ark. That night, Azarias did exactly as Michael commanded, and sure enough, their entourage found that all the temple doors were open and the guards were all indisposed. The crew of righteous thieves were successful. The ark was successfully packed away, and Menelik and his whole entourage left Jerusalem before anyone was the wiser. A few days later, King Solomon found himself feeling sorrowful. He thought again of his dream about the radiant sun, and he realized that that sun actually symbolized the Ark of the Covenant. So he asked his high priest, Azarias' father, Zadok, if he could go and check and see if the ark was still safely inside the temple. When Zadok went and looked, sure enough, the ark was gone. Solomon made a final desperate attempt to recover the ark and sent out his fastest riders after Menelik's entourage. But it was hopeless, because Menelik's entourage were being sped home thanks to the combined power of the Ark and the Archangel Michael. Menelik only learned that his entourage had the Ark after they'd left Jerusalem. But then the Archangel Michael appeared before them. He then levitated the entire party 1 cubit off the ground, that's about 18 inches, and he sped them back to Ethiopia. Now, I really want to linger on this image for a minute because I love it. Imagine an ancient king and a giant caravan all flying through the air about a foot and a half off the ground. I don't know. I think that's great. Menelik and his group even managed to miraculously cross the Red Sea, echoing the original flight of the Israelites back in the book of Exodus. Upon Menelik's triumphant return, his mother, the Queen of Sheba, abdicated her throne. And Menelik, with his new court transplanted from Jerusalem, began his reign, blessed by the presence of the Ark. This was the start of Ethiopia's Solomonic dynasty and the inauguration of Ethiopia as God's new holy land. The Ark has remained safely in Ethiopia until this very day. Or at least, so goes the tale. Man, it's quite a story, and one that differs markedly from the traditions found in the Bible. The Kibra Nagust offers a version of Ethiopian history, and frankly, world history, that is completely unique. So the question is, how should we incorporate the story found in the Kibra Nagust into our understanding of ancient history? Have we in the West been ignoring an important piece in the history of monotheistic religion? Perhaps the sun has been shining on Ethiopia for longer than many of us have fully realized. Okay, that's all for this week. Join us again in 2 weeks' time when we will continue our examination of Ethiopia's history. Before we go this week, I just want to take a minute and recommend that all of you check out a podcast on the podcast network I'm on right now, Podcast One, by Jordan Harbinger. Yes, the Jordan Harbinger podcast. I'm plugging it again because I think it's a podcast that our fake history listeners will actually really enjoy. Jordan Harbinger's mission is simply to make you better informed, make you a more critical thinker, even give you a sense of what's happening inside your own brain. To that end, he's having conversations with different fascinating guests on every episode, and there really is something here for everyone. I think our fake history listeners might be particularly interested in hearing his recent conversation with Michael Shermer. He's the director of the Skeptic Society and one of the founders of Skeptic Magazine. You might know him from that debate he did with our old buddy Graham Hancock. So check that out. But also, he's got interviews with people like Kobe Bryant, the late great, or someone like Danny Trejo. So this is a show that's worth listening to. So check out the Jordan Harbinger podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you're getting your podcasts. Or just go to jordanharbinger.com/subscribe. Before we go this week, I also need to give a very special shout out to the following people. Big ups to Walter Mathis, to Whitney Hurt, to Christopher Heed, to Megan Frested, to Gavin Edwards, to Henry, to Paul Kroon, to Marty Garner, and to Austin Watt. All of you folks have decided to pledge at $5 or more every month on Patreon. So you know what that means? You are all beautiful human beings. Thanks again to everyone who's supporting on Patreon or anyone who's making one-time donations at ourfakehistory.com or anyone that's buying our merch at tpublic.com. I do have an announcement for anyone supporting on Patreon. I've got a new edition of Our Fake History in conversation coming your way very soon. So keep your eyes open for that. If you're interested in supporting on Patreon and getting all the awesome extras that come with that subscription, go to patreon.com/ourfakehistory and check out the level of support that works for you. If you want to get in touch with me, you can always send me an email at ourfakehistory@gmail.com. You can hit me up on Twitter at ourfakehistory. You can hit me up on Instagram at ourfakehistory, or you can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/ourfakehistory. As always, the theme music for the show comes to us from Dirty Church. You can check out Dirty Church at dirtychurch.bandcamp.com. And all the other music you heard on the show today was written and recorded by me. My name is Sebastian Major, and remember, just because it didn't happen doesn't mean it isn't real.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
When your space has the long-lasting, noticeable scent of Airwick Vibrant Scented Oils, you'll want to invite everyone over, from book club to the fantasy league, even the in-laws.
It smells amazing.
Airwick Vibrant Scented Oils are infused with 2 times more natural essential oils versus regular Airwick scented oils for our most authentic, nature-inspired fragrance experience. Transform your space with scents like white sage and mahogany or lavender and water lily. Now that's a breath of fresh Airwick.